I'm Leah Flitch, and I'm an 11th grader at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Mara Sheedy, a senior at Oakland Catholic.
This is Isabella Victoria, a sophomore at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Serena Zetz, and I'm also a sophomore at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Malik Johnson, a senior from Pittsburgh Alderdice.
This is CJ Nemeth from Propel Braddock Hills High School. And our first topic today, teenage demographics and stereotypes and how they affect social justice in modern America. Now, we have a question here from my friend Malik. Malik, would you like to start us out?
Do you feel like we have any rights as teenagers? And what rights do you think we have?
I was kind of thinking about earlier is that teenagers don't really have a lack of rights. Essentially, it's the fact that there's so many rights, but it's not exactly individual rights. There's a lot of rights that protect us. For example, like the fact that we have to go to school every day or the fact that our parents have to like be in charge of us. But as for individuals, say, I don't know. I think that's where we're definitely lacking, if somebody else would like to add to that.
Now, you said individual rights. Do you feel we need more? And if so, what type exactly? Like, do you feel almost like, because I get what you're saying, like we lack individual rights. Do you mean almost like how adults are treated, or you feel less? That's what I'm curious about.
I think it's just the fact that you have to go by like a lot of other rules or like expectations first. Like you can't just like do something because you want to. Like you'd have to like confer with a parent or something, or like you have like certain obligations that like you're forced to do type of thing. It's just that we don't really have, I think, freedom kind of is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I agree with Mara. I think that also there needs to be more places for teens to have their own ideas and forums.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is the idea that we need to have rights just in what we're allowed to say and what we're allowed to do in schools and out of schools and what change we can create. So there should be more public spaces just for teens' ideas overall, I think.
I think that our biggest right as a teenager is our education, and since we're all in high school, we know and like appreciate that. But obviously our education system has some room for improvement, especially in Pennsylvania. Like this year, our state budget still hasn't passed, so a lot of our public schools aren't getting the resources that they're needed. So I think if we're going to analyze the rights of teenagers, we have to also take into account the other systems that are working with us and against us.
So we keep bringing up rights and we keep bringing up high school and whatnot. So the question I have that I'd really like all of you to answer for this is, well, as teenagers, where do we qualify as a teen and as an adult? Because I feel that's the question that a lot of people don't really understand. And the stereotype that's given to us is that teens are just masquerading as chaotic individuals who go off of just instruction. Where do we draw that line of, okay, we're responsible and mature and we're not irresponsible?
I think that one of the things we have to take into account when we think about what is a teen and what is an adult is the amount of maturity that teens and adults have. I know that by the time you're 25, your brain is fully matured, but from that period, from being 18 to 25, where you're still a very young adult, you aren't fully matured yet. So I think when we talk about teen versus young adult, we need to figure out what that means in levels of maturity, maybe more, I mean, less than just age, because age overall, you can't just say when you turn 18, you're suddenly an adult.
Yeah, I agree with Leah. I think that our current sort of distinction between kid and adult is just age, and that's too clear cut to like take into account everything else that these teens are going through. Like people have different backgrounds and different incomes and different family situations, and I think those all play a part into how mature they are and if they are a teenager or an adult.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Leah and Serena. And I think just as Serena was saying, like not every teen is the same, just like not every adult is the same or every like kid is the same. We all have different backgrounds and like different ways that we've grown up, and different like situations definitely play a part in how we're reacting to things.
I definitely agree that it's a that like every individual is different and all that, but like I think it also is kind of good that we have like guidelines and like a procession of things. Like for example, you get like your driver's license when you're 16, and then you get like the right to vote, then right to drink, and like it all kind of progresses. But at the same time, like we can't have those like check marks essentially for like everything in our life. So like one day we're at school and we have to like ask to go to the bathroom, and the next day we're like out in the world on our own. So it's like there's definitely some gaps in the system. Like it makes sense for certain things and we definitely have some sort of progression, but like then there's so many other things where there's like nothing. So it's kind of
so you were going off like checkmark system and whatnot. So you were saying earlier about rules and individuality. So what do you feel is something we could do that would affect the majority that would still keep our individuality but also keep those guidelines in check for us? What do you feel would be the best assumption for that, or if there's any idea you have right now? Or
it's kind of hard because like there are so many like rules and regulations already in place. But I think like kind of going off more an individual idea is maybe like I mean, if it were possible, for example, like driver's test, maybe not say you have to be 16, but just have the test and like road test. And if you can pass and you're 14, then good for you. If you're 18 and you still can't pass it, then you know what I mean? Like not putting an age on it from the beginning. I think we kind of set, like humans obviously love time. So like maybe if we kind of stepped aside from that.
I also think that having more responsibility in school and things that we can have that are already in place for those institutions. Because if you think about it, we spend 8 hours every day in school. And I think that that is really a place where we can find what we're supposed to do in life and what we can find for our individuality and maybe progress and grow there more rather than just kind of throwing us into this world, as you said, having to raise your hand one day and then the next day having to go to college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that a huge part of our adolescence is that it's basically just a series of milestones, like graduating high school, like going to college, getting your driver's license and everything, but I don't think it should be like valued that way because not everyone follows that same exact series of events, and especially like teens of color and teens of other demographics, like their lives are obviously going to be different than someone, than a teenager who's white. And so I think that it shouldn't be as like, our definition of like youth and adult shouldn't be as distinctive as it is now and should include more people.
I mean, have you guys, like, kind of going off of that ever or, like, heard of any kind of stories or anything for anyone who's, like, felt discriminated by their age, for example, or, like, yourself?
You know, I don't have, like, a personal one, but if you go off historical information, you were talking earlier, I know, about, they just mentioned about the colors and whatnot. I know there's a very famous individual from history who, he is a renowned particle physicist, and he couldn't get an education, he couldn't get here, he was downgraded, and his name was Albert Einstein. So the question I have for that is, you know, why is it – exactly. You laugh at that, but it's so true. You know, this individual couldn't afford to go to college because he was German. So why is it we affect, you know, teenagers about basically color, ethnicity, and whatnot? Why is it we do that, and why is it that's something that we still do in the 21st century? Because there are still people like that today. I mean, I use this as a reference because it's a movie, but it's a good movie. Good Will Hunting, he was affected because he was crazy. But, hey, it was still a good point.
I think that a huge problem that's in the education system, if we're discussing teens and college in that process, is the fact that people of color are disproportionately less likely to go to college, and that ties into people of color being disproportionately a part of poor neighborhoods. And I feel like that all is just this cycle that we've created in the education system. And part of the thing that's been helpful has been creating spots for these people in colleges throughout the country, but there's still a very large gap just because of like the disproportionately poor neighborhoods and that cycle that the education system has. So if anyone wants to speak to how that disproportionately affects people of color.
And then also going off of that, after people of color typically from poor neighborhoods get to college, there's obviously the school to prison pipeline in place. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we want systematic change to occur, then our generation needs to figure out how to break that cycle. And I think we're starting to do that by the third wave of feminism and like the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm like really proud of our peers and ourselves. But I think that we need to stop discussing ideas with people of like minds and start spreading that to people who disagree with us.
I think kind of going off that, it's such a complex issue because like we're just talking about that in like the school system, but before that it started with like housing and like after World War II, like and how they distributed things and like the suburban sprawl and all that and where they decided to tear down and force people to move. So it's kind of like an ongoing thing. You can't just say it just starts with education, but like there's so much like backstory to it, and like this has been going on for like hundreds of years. So I think even though we have a lot of ideas, it's like it's definitely going to take a lot of work.
Yeah, I agree with that. And like something that's really sort of like amazes me about just being in high school and like going to school with lots of different people is how much like I learn, not just from like the teachers and classes, but like a lot of my friends and peers and just classmates that share like their ideas or their work, their knowledge about social justice topics, and like it sort of widens everyone's horizons.
Yeah, I think that teens our age really have an advantage when it comes to how we're learning and growing all the time. So if we can take our advantage when it comes to being involved in that environment and just being part of like new wave things, then if we work with people who are powerful, so people that already have been established, like adults in mm-hmm. politics or adults in other sort of systems, then we can really create change what we want to see just with more established people.
I want to go back to what Mara said about education and how that affects it. I think education is a really important part of how you go about changing these issues, because if you do know about these issues, it is easier to kind of fix them and put things on the right track. And
so I want to go back on like what Mara and even Mikhail and what everybody said. So we have all these identifiers with education, and people talk about we should go there and we have all these abilities. And Leo earlier was saying about how, you know, we have all these opportunities as teens nowadays in the 21st century. But I think one of the biggest problems that we as a face as a whole is the media downplays so much with both stereotypes and color, ethnicity, feminism, Black Lives Movement. Everyone downgrades it, and I think because of that, we as teenagers don't naturally have that mindset because we're like a sponge. We don't think we can do it, and it's because of that it's where we get that down trust. So I feel to change that, we first need to implement that negative media and need to get rid of it first, so this way positivity can come into play.
I kind of disagree with your point that the media like downgrades, or like, what were you saying? Could you repeat
it? I was saying, you get the media, and there's so much negativity placed on the media. You talk about, like, schools, shootings, and people being doing drugs and whatnot. They never really play in the positive aspect, like, okay, he was from a poor household. They don't talk about, okay, he had no help. They just immediately go with, oh, he was a drug addict. They don't talk about the things that affected it to that point.
Well, I disagree with that because I think that part of the media, like, its point is to make people uncomfortable and to spark a discussion about things that they typically wouldn't talk about. So in your instance with that example, I think that a lot of the media does talk about all the factors that play into the example that you said, and that if they're talking about how the perpetrator is like a drug abuser, it sparks a whole discussion about our drug culture.
I think part of the reason media is such a double-edged sword is because it can work in your favor when it comes to spreading movements like the Black Lives Movement and protests and like getting people there. But on the other side, it can also downplay the things that are happening. So it could talk about like the riots that are happening in a very negative light, even though there's also progress happening on the other side of town. So while the media is doing this, it might also be downplaying the progress that's happening.
Just to like tie it all together, I mean, media gives a lot of opportunities to like of people who normally wouldn't be able to express their opinion, the ability. So like, for example, even us here today, like we're teenagers, we don't always get to broadcast our feelings out to like a whole radio station. So kind of tying it all together, like it is giving us this opportunity, and with blogs and social networks, like there's all kinds of ways people can too.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Streaming Justice, a youth-led discussion on civil rights, past, present, and future in honor of Dr. King. This is Isabella Victoria, and I'm a sophomore at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Mara Sheedy, a senior at Oakland Catholic.
This is Leah DeFlitch. I am an 11th grader at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is CJ Nemeth from Propel Braddock Hills High School, and I'm a senior.
This is Malik Johnson, a senior from Pittsburgh Alderdice.
And I'm Serena Zetz, a sophomore at Pittsburgh Kappa. So the topic that I next wanted to tackle was feminism, and I was wondering what your insights were to how do you think that modern movements for civil rights and women's rights and like LGBTQIA plus rights can work together and build off of each other?
I think the first thing that we should discuss in that sort of question would be intersectionality. And for those who don't know, intersectionality is basically the work of all movements. So feminism, LGBTQ movements, and racial movements to a greater good and to a greater, more equal world. So a big thing that should be the focus of that intersectionality is building off of the other one's successes in order to create more equality and more overall just reform in the systems.
I think one thing also to keep in mind is that feminism and civil rights movements, they do go hand in hand. You know, back in the day, they were really close-knit, and even today you still see like feminist groups attending Black Lives Matter movements and Black Lives Matter movements attend feminist rallies.
Yeah, personally, I feel that it's natural almost for them to like coexist. If you think about it, I mean, yes, they all have their differences in what exactly they're trying to achieve, but like the main message is just equality for everyone. And I think no matter where you are in the world, no matter what situation, we're lacking on equality like in so many ways. And I think really everyone, I mean, needs to work on that.
I agree with you 100%, Mara, yeah. When you talk about they're all for equality. But I think the one thing that I feel why these groups kind of get sometimes negative attention is I feel the problem is no one truly identifies the difference between what group is for equality and what group is for like almost superiority is what I'm trying to say. Because
agree with that. Yeah,
because you have these organizations out there like, you know, you have the Black Panthers, for example, who they were for the civil rights movement, but they did some things that weren't really humanitarian. So it's kind of like you have to look at the majority. You can't look at the majority. You have to look at the minority section of it. So I feel the one thing people need to do first before these movements come together to represent equality is they need to identify what is for the greater good of everyone and what is just trying to gain an edge in the political party.
I think a big issue when we're talking about social justice is the media's attention on the negative of social justice, because often the negative light of social justice is people believing that social justice is taken too far, or that when people say they're feminists, they actually just want to rule the world with other like ladies by their side, when in actuality, feminism is just about equality of the sexes and equal opportunity and pay and having this intersectionality that really works together and builds off of everybody. So I think that if we're talking about the difference between superiority that maybe like crazy like feminists want to create, that's not what feminism is. And so I know that the media can paint that picture, which is often a huge problem, because when the media paints that picture, that means that people are being misinformed about what a social justice movement is trying to create. And what in reality a social justice is trying to do is to create bigger and better opportunities for those who have been marginalized their entire lives.
Yeah, I think that a huge factor in our country's sort of misinformed like dialogue and views on topics like equality for women and for racial minorities, and I think that it's partly because our media is like powered by misogyny. I mean, if you look at the stories that get a ton of attention, like the NFL players like beating their wives or other topics along that lines. Like, we find so much interest. Advertisers are willing to pay money for spots that are about, like, campus rape. And instead of addressing the actual topics, we always talk about it after a tragedy happens. But I think that we need to spark a dialogue before it could happen again.
I think there's also a problem with all these movements and like media and going back is people just kind of want to say things rather than kind of listen to like what others are saying or like really identify with exactly what they're about. So I think kind of going back to like what you've said about those people who are trying to become superiority, I feel like that's like a misinformed person if that, because that's really going almost against what they're for if they really get down to the roots of it.
Going back to what Leah was saying about the misconceptions of social justice movements, specifically she was talking about how feminism can be painted in a certain light. I think we also see this with the Black Lives Matter movement, with people saying all lives matter, and how like, yes, it's true, but we're trying to focus on like a specific group of people that right now their lives are almost being considered like not as important. But we're trying to paint the picture that Black Lives Matter are just as important.
Yeah, I was going to say it's no crime to like promote one certain group, even though you're obviously for like the entire like human sector and for everyone. And yes, everyone does have rights. But when one group is being oppressed, there's nothing wrong with trying to make awareness to that certain group. And
yes.
I think people try to paint in a light. Everyone's right that if one group is just kind of like raise awareness or something, then it's like, oh, they're forgetting about the whole rest of the world. Well, it's like, no, they're not. It's just because everyone else is up here and they're down here in the way of how they're being treated. So
I think that the media backlash and like misconceptions about these topics are kind of like they're warranted, and like I can understand why they happen. And it's because these movements are like threatening our country's power structure, and people are claiming that we're oppressing the oppressor, but we're really just trying to get an equal playing field for everyone.
And not to go back with Serena on like almost everything you said, it's very agreeable with when a problem arises like in the media, we look at just one section of it, like as you said, misogyny with like the campus rape and whatnot. It's just, for some reason, I don't understand how the media goes with the negativity. We look at one consequence and one side of the coin when there's two sides to every problem. We don't look at every detail. We don't look at the solutions first. We look at the problem before anything else. And, of course, this is where I say Marxism is the ruler. There we go. Go communism. Yay.
Okay, so I think to wrap up this section, it's basically feminism and social justice movements as a whole are often painted in a negative light. But in reality, most of the time, we're just trying to get an equal playing field. And social justice is all about creating opportunities for the marginalized among us.
Good afternoon, Pittsburgh. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Streaming Justice, a youth-led discussion on civil rights, past, present, and future, in honor of Dr. King. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love your participation. You can call or text us at 412-200-5975 or tweet your questions at hashtag PGH Youth Express. And I am CJ from Propel Braddock Hills, a senior. Now on down to the line.
My name is Malik Johnson. I'm a senior from Pittsburgh Olderdice.
This is Serena Zetz. I'm a sophomore at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Isabella Victoria, and I'm also a sophomore at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Mara Sheedy, a senior at Oakland Catholic.
This is Leah DeFlitch, a junior at Pittsburgh Kappa High School. I thought the next topic we could discuss would be the criminal justice system and mass incarceration. And I also thought that we could relate that to Black lives and how it disproportionately affects people of color. So the first question I wanted to pose to you guys was, do you think the treatment of African Americans in the criminal justice system, and if we want to expand on what that is, reflects a problem or a greater issue in American society, and especially the racism that follows that sort of thing?
Well, I think that our criminal justice system and its treatment of Black prisoners or Black members of our society is a reflection of like an outdated cultural shift. Like, I don't think it's fully caught up to date with how our country is changing and how it's becoming more tolerant and more equal. And like, if you just look at the instance of mandatory drug sentencing, that was heavy during, like, the 80s and 90s during the big drug, like, wave. Those are still in place, and it's disproportionately affecting Black prisoners because it basically went after, like, Black communities, and it was working to keep them down. And I think that even though our country has sort of culturally shifted away from that, our criminal justice system isn't up to that.
And I feel, going off of that, agreeing fully with you about how it's an old school justice testament towards the, you know, racial bias, I feel the problem also is in our education, we don't fully indulge upon that topic at all with, like, younger children. We might indulge upon it in, like, middle and high school, but when you're in elementary and you're a child and your brain is absorbing all this information, we don't really touch on the exact racial prejudice we used to do back in the days. And, you know, even there's parts of the South, I've even seen them myself personally, that they still don't tolerate things such as, you know, other beings of ethnicities, etc., all that are other than white. So I feel the problem is we need to get upon education first so as to strengthen this ideal upon unification through differentiality.
Yeah, I think that a huge issue is that although you talked about the South and how that racial bias still exists there, I think that's everywhere. And a huge thing is that bias that we started with throughout history and the history of the United States hasn't gone away. It's just become more unconscious. And when we don't see it as a conscious thing, we don't want to deal with it. We don't want to, like, say that it exists there. And Serena, you brought up the war on drugs. And the war on drugs is really this Black-centered thing. And I think that when the war on drugs was created and then the war on putting prisoners in the system, it was really just to put African Americans in cages. It was to put them back into a place where they were just inferior to other people.
I just wanted to bring up the point that, I mean, this has kind of become like a recent discussion, I feel like, in pop culture. And it almost seems trendy to, like, you know, kind of be in support of all different races and, like, be aware of these problems and, like, tweet things. But then when it comes down to it, like, these same people who claim they're, like, involved and passionate for them are the same people who are putting these people in jail or, like, not really being open to different cultures or different races, things like that. So I think, like, what you said, I like the point whoever brought up about, like, elementary school and, like, teaching people that this is, like, still an issue and that we need to, like, see people as humans, not really as something to, like, be a hashtag or something.
Yeah, I agree with Mara, and I think that the point that she's trying to raise is that it's hard for people who haven't experienced, like, racial profiling or racial bias. Like, they can't put themselves in the situation, and so while it's easy for them to, like, go and tweet, like, Black Lives Matter, like, they're never going to have to experience that, and they're never going to have to feel the effects of it.
Mm-hmm. I think it is important, though, just to mention that not just tweeting is really important, but action, like, actually going out to, like, rallies and things, you do see, you know, people who do get arrested and beaten, things like that. That is everyone. That's not just Black people who do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you really did want to experience what it is, or I don't know why you would want to experience it, but, you know, that is a way to, like, relate to it.
Another thing I think that's really important is educating yourself on what is happening in the world around us, whether it's, like, learning from other people or, like, taking it upon yourself to, like, learn before you say things that you're not educated about.
And I want to go off what you were saying, Isabella, about educating ourselves on further. I feel one thing we don't truly do is we don't really teach anyone. This is in all qualifications of education, elementary, middle, and high school. We don't talk about things outside of the country, the United States. We talk about our own history, but our own individual children, teenagers, etc., don't know our own history. But the thing that drives me insane is we don't learn about everything from the past. We don't learn about such as the British culture, the prime ministers, etc. Yet you go to Europe. I have many friends throughout the, you know, Ireland and whatnot, and they talk about they know history of both their country as well as American demographics and politics. And the thing I feel is one thing to really unify us as a people is if we as Americans learn both our history, the things we've done that were bad and things we've done are good, and that might just change a little bit about how we look at each other.
While I do agree with your point to like some extent, I think mm-hmm. that a bigger issue in schools is the lack of education in African American lessons or women's mm-hmm. history or just people that have been oppressed overall, so LGBTQ studies. Mm-hmm. Because when we don't have, if you're a person of color or if you identify as LGBTQ, if you don't know your history to begin with, it's really hard to build off of that and to create a movement that is already based in history. And I think a large part of social justice is already learning about what has happened before and how that can be built on. And our education system is really failing us in terms of creating history that isn't just about white people or about men, because I know that history can be based in that, but we also need to look at the wider scope of mm-hmm. things.
I think it's also important not just to include the classes, but also to make sure that they are on par with what European classes are. You know, European history right. is an advanced placement college class. African American history is a mainstream class. Women's studies is not even a history. It is a extra credit class you take.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly.
I'm just kind of going off of that, like the importance of education. I recently read an article in the Post-Gazette about Pittsburgh area elementary school. I think it was a charter school. I'm not exactly sure. But they're in a predominantly like African-American neighborhood with predominantly African-American students. And they were finding mm-hmm. that by really embracing like an African-American history was making their students actually succeed. Like by I think they would have like daily lessons on like African-American history or like bring up like an African-American notable leader or something like that, but like kind of like embracing that. And they were finding like the enormous success it's had with their students is really empowering. So I think like if you apply that same principle to like all different like walks of life or like what you were talking about with like feminism and like things like that, like giving a history on that, like I think it really has a lot of power.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note that, to go back to CJ's earlier point about how our education isn't up to par and how our history history classes are always about like European culture or North American culture, but it's not only just history classes. Like all of our classes are Eurocentric. Like we like in math we always learn about Pythagoras, but we don't learn that like Arabs invented algebra.
Yeah.
And so I think that we need a complete change of our education system, and not even just in social studies courses.
So just to go back a little bit to the criminal justice system and how it relates to education, do we want to discuss the school-to-prison pipeline or how that affects people of color, specifically just overall the ideas of that? They want to speak to that? Or I guess I could pose a question. So
yeah, that'd be better.
Yeah, I will do that.
Yeah, really.
It's a big.
Yeah, it's a very large scope. Mm-hmm. So how does, if we have such a large school-to-prison pipeline, how can we change that, or how can we create an alternative to that to make it more about education and more about reform and not just about sending people to prison and locking them away so they can't vote or they can't participate in a larger society? What are alternatives to that?
Well, I think that at its core, our country needs to sort of reevaluate our budget, our federal budget, and also our state level budgets, because like they base how much money they're going to spend on new prisons off mm-hmm. of standardized testing scores. And so I think that if we wanted to change the school to prison pipeline, we would have to reevaluate how we spend our money in both of those systems.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I think that also a large issue is for-profit prisons and things that are created by the government in order to profit off those that are already incarcerated, and how we can change the rate of incarceration by changing the school system overall.
I concur with that. I also concur with Serena talking about SAT scores. I feel one thing that doesn't really help, because you were talking earlier, Serena, about how they base upon like the budget for prisons based on SAT scores. I feel with just testing in general, we don't require, because going back to a way earlier discussion, we're talking about teenagers and talking about education, and there's testing and check marks in place for everything. I feel by having less of those, you lessen the idea of criminal basism, because if they base basically off of, okay, prison budget off, okay, X amount of people in a state get this score in SATs, that's to me isn't really fair, because I read an article recently that stated that SAT scores are reflected not by the amount of like education you've had, but by the amount of money you and your family generally make. Mm-hmm. So I feel, how is that really supporting equality? Because the idea is that if people are poor and, you know, they're at that low economic era, how is that fair to everyone? That's basically saying all the poor should go to prison, almost, and to what my eye sees that perspective.
Yeah, I think that something that goes along with the school-to-prison pipeline is that we need to make sure that education is coming first for, like, teens. And I think it's just, like, it's, like, terrible how prisons are based off of schools and, like, but I think that school should be for education, not for deciding how many people are going to be going to prison. Like, it just doesn't match up to me.
I think it's really cool that all of us are still in high school and we're recognizing this problem. And I think it's also really interesting that a lot of the, like, presidential candidates and people in power sort of, like, speaking about this, like, with the Democratic candidates. Like, Bernie Sanders has a plan for, like college loan reform and everything, so that it could help more people get into college and be able to sustain that. And I think it's really interesting.
I think it's also important to kind of shift what we are learning in schools, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In schools, we don't learn a lot of, like, business things or things that are actually going to help us out in the real world things, you know. Mm-hmm. Lifestyle classes, and if you do help that, it does make it easier to adjust into the adult life and not commit crime.
Yeah.
And going off of that, I want to say one last thing before we do cut off, is I feel one big problem we have is we have general education, like elementary to high school, that's all free for us, but I feel college, which most careers that we want to get into, they require that. I feel by having it such a high end and costing it so much and then having people go into debt on a constant basis, I feel that is a big problem. So they either need to cut how much you need to go to college or need to just get rid of that ideal completely, because I know I keep going off Europe, but we need to go with a socialistic reform, but hey, back to the music.
Just to wrap this up, I think the way you came to the consensus that we are privileged to have our education system, but its discriminatory practices have room for improvement. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Streaming Justice, a youth-led discussion on civil rights, past, present, and future, in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King. If you would like to join in the conversation, we'd love to have your participation. You can call or text us at 412-200-5975 or tweet questions to PGH Youth Express. This is Serena Zetz, a sophomore from Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Isabella Victoria. I'm also a sophomore at Pittsburgh Kappa.
This is Mara Sheedy, a senior at Oakland Catholic.
This is Leah DeFlitch, a junior at Kappa High School.
This is CJ, a senior from Propel Braddock Hills High School.
This is Malik Johnson, a senior from Pittsburgh Olderdice. I just wanted to ask and kind of talk about Tulsa, Oklahoma. Back in the day, in the 1920s, it was known as Black Wall Street. It was a neighborhood, black when Oklahoma was just becoming a state. A lot of black people came there. A lot of black people who fled from Indian tribes went to Oklahoma. And eventually it just became a lot of businesses, a lot of doctors. One of the best doctors was even like recognized from one of the best medical institutions in the country. Do you guys know anything about it or have anything you want to say?
So when I first read those, I didn't know anything about it, but to establish, like you said, it was a very rich black community in northern Oklahoma, and it gained a lot of racial tension because a lot of people didn't like it, and eventually in the 1920s, there was a race riot that actually burned it to the ground, and majority of the community had to flee, and it took them about 5 years to rebuild it, and it's a fascinating thing, and I feel the way we can apply this to a modern-day credential is that stuff like this happens still today, and especially like you look at the 60s and like when King was around, you had the crosses burning in the yards. I still read on the news that stuff like that still happens, and I feel that's something that we need to get rid of, is that racial prejudice that's been around for centuries. It needs to die out. Just, it's the 21st century. Get rid of it.
I think in regards to Black Wall Street, it's really interesting to evaluate and think about how race and commerce and like capitalism work together, because like today Atlanta, Georgia has the wealthiest like black population in our country, and it's sort of interesting to see how like successful people like group together and form hubs.
I think if we're going to talk about capitalism and that sort of thing with Black Wall Street, we want to talk about the inequality gap that's plaguing America right now, because as we continue into the future, the inequality gap has actually widened between rich classes and poor classes, and right now the top 1% holds 51% of the entire money in America, which is a huge problem because we have the majority of Americans living in poverty, I mean not the majority of Americans living in poverty, but a huge amount living in poverty while the few successful are holding almost all of our assets, which is disproportionately affecting Black people, disproportionately affecting people of color. So I think to discuss capitalism and wealth inequality, we also have to discuss race.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And kind of going back with what you talked about with the race riots in place, thinking about like how gentrification, like what's that doing too? Because like with bringing in like wealthier individuals and taking them over, like predominantly lower individuals, neighborhoods and such, and a lot of those places are of minority peoples. We could talk about that too and how that factors everything, because I think a lot about gentrification.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to go back to what Serena said about Atlanta, Georgia being the one of the richest, like, you know, Black communities. I was watching a video the other day about Hurricane Katrina, and I was reading about this, that to this day there are still neighborhoods, predominantly Black neighborhoods, that have not been repaired, and they still have the damages from there. So going off like the capitalism, how you say 1% owns 51% of the wealth, I feel one of the problems is we as Americans, with the capitalist viewpoint we naturally adhere ourselves to, I feel we don't wish to give away that much. In fact, you know, going off personal, look at the Powerball, $1.3 billion. Why do we have that? Seriously, that could be given to so many organizations, but we choose not to. So I think it's not just race. It's also just people
the
want
way our society is
exactly,
like.
Exactly. Power corrupts. People who have power just want to keep it. And I think that's the problem, is we as Americans, that capitalist viewpoint, we just keep and we don't need to change it. I think we need to change it to more so like a Marxist point of view, or maybe something different, but capitalism, bane of society.
I also want to go back to Katrina, New Orleans. It was a really good town back before Katrina. It still is not.
And that was 10 years ago, too. Mm-hmm. I mean.
And it still has a lot of murder, theft. Those are all really huge issues in New Orleans still today after Hurricane Katrina.
I sort of wanted to respond to like Mara's point about gentrification and how it affects our communities. I mean, if you look at the Hill District in Pittsburgh, it's so close to all of us. But we see now it's sort of making a comeback. But back in like the mid-1900s, there's like such artists as like Teenie Harris and August Wilson. Mm-hmm. And it was such like a cultural center. But then it became like a food desert and they didn't have any grocery stores. And now people are trying to change that with like the Hill House. And they just brought back their first grocery store. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important to talk about not just like a larger scope of the topic, but also how it directly impacts us.
I think when we need to discuss gentrification, we need to look at what the difference is between repairing neighborhoods and just sort of shoving housing in there and then raising the prices exponentially to the point where people that were already living there can't afford to live there anymore. Because as soon as you put housing in there or higher development, it becomes really hard for residents of that area to begin to pay for their housing or their rent, and it will push them out of the area. And so by doing that, you're pushing out the people that have already been living there for so long, and you're just creating a new type of neighborhood instead of maybe fixing the existing problems or keeping the culture or keeping what they've already had created.
Yeah, Leah makes a really good point when discussing gentrification and like the effect it has, especially on local businesses, that those local businesses had such a big cultural impact for maybe years, many years at a time in the neighborhoods that they're in, that it's like sad to see gentrification take its toll and like have a new business come in that maybe doesn't even benefit the community as much, or that is unaffordable for the people living in that community.
I feel that like gentrification sometimes too is like kind of trying to create some sort of like monotony, like not even just with like restaurants or like shops or whatever else they're trying to put in there, but like race too and like economic status too, which is really unfortunate, because I think as much as we're like pushing for diversity now, like we're not, like it's kind of like eliminating it, honestly, when you come down to it. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to add on that?
I think just on the whole, ever since 2008, our economy has been so weak, and like with housing and with all of our like social programs that we have in place, like Social Security and everything, it's just gone downhill. And I think that we sort of need to figure out how we can make a rebound and how we can support our people and potentially be able to have another Black Wall Street in our modern culture.
I actually want to go completely off you there, Serena, and I want to agree with you 100%. I feel one thing we could do with the economy to fix it is we spend less money on our defense budget. We spend several hundred billion on a daily basis. And I just recently read we spend about billion on just our prison budget. I feel if we can figure out ways to just lower those costs, we can strengthen, like how we had Malik here talking about New Orleans and the penalties they face, and we were talking about diversity with Mara. If we can figure out ways to just cut all of those expenses we pay yearly in half, we can fix everything with all these diverse races and all these people who live in poverty on a day-to-day basis, and I feel that's something we really need to look at as a whole.
I think the sad thing is, like, neighborhoods and such and schools are, like, really based off of, like, economic status and, like, race status, and I wish we could just have a laissez-faire, like everyone just like kind of intermingle. I mean, I hate to even say it like that because it sounds so forced. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like that would solve all the problems, but like the problem is you can't just do that. And the thing is, like, unless you impose some kind of boundaries, then like things won't work. But if you impose these kind of boundaries, then like it's just too forced. So like we need to find some kind of like
sort of like a middle ground,
happy medium. Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with Maura. I think that when we're talking about economics and we're talking about race and we're talking about sexuality and we're talking about feminism, all those things, it's really important to look at them as a whole. It's really important to talk about intersectionality and not just one thing and one aspect, but how they all connect. And I think what this is trying to do is discuss it in terms of youth and discuss it in terms of what we're trying to do with people of power to create a better society overall.
That's all the time that we have. Thanks for supporting Streaming Justice. Up next is more music and conversation about civil rights, past, present, and future, in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Day.